org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
The way we eat has changed more in the last 50 years than in the previous 10,000. The modern supermarket has on average 47,000 products.
The industry doesn't want you to know the truth about what you're eating, because if you knew, you might not want to eat it.
We've never had food companies this powerful in our history.
Everything we've done in modern agriculture is to grow it faster, fatter, bigger, cheaper.
If you could grow a chicken in 49 days, why would you want one you got to grow in 3 months?
When you go through the supermarket, there is an illusion of diversity. So much of our industrial food turns out to be rearrangements of corn.
Sometimes you look at a vegetable and say, okay, well, we can get 2 hamburgers for the same price.
They have managed to make it against the law to criticize their products.
There is an effort to make it illegal to publish a photo of any industrial food operation.
I find it incredible that the FDA wants to allow the sale of meat from cloned animals without any labeling.
Peanut butter contaminated with salmonella.
E. coli has been found in spinach, apple juice.
Smells like money to me.
The average consumer does not feel very powerful. It's the exact opposite. When we run an item past the supermarket scanner, we're voting for local or not, organic or not.
Look at the tobacco industry. The battle against tobacco is a perfect model of how an industry's irresponsible behavior can be changed.
Imagine what it would be if, as a national policy, the idea would be to have such nutritionally dense food that people actually felt better, had more energy, and weren't sick as much. You know, now see, that's a noble goal.
And that was an excerpt of the Oscar-nominated documentary Food, Inc. Today, we're going to spend the hour with one of the key voices in that film, journalist and best-selling author Michael Pollan. He's among the nation's leading writers and thinkers on food and food policy. He's the Knight Professor of Science and Environmental Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley School of Journalism. He's written several books about food, including The Botany of Desire, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and In Defense of Food, and Eater's Manifesto, his latest book, Food Rules and Eater's Manual. Well, Sharif Abdelkaddous and I sat down with Michael Pollan here in our studio in New York last month. Michael Pollan, welcome to Democracy Now! And this is our rule for you, our food rule. No sound bites. Give us the whole meal.
You got it.
Okay. Food rules, an eater's manual. What are the rules?
Well, there are 64 of them, and they're very simple, and they're just, I was trying to, I've been reporting on the food system, on agriculture and health and nutrition, and for 10 years now, and the people are always asking me, well, okay, I get it, but what do I do? What do I eat? What do I buy? And so I tried to write a book that really distilled everything I had learned into some very kind of sticky, memorable, you know, rules for eating. They all come down to the big, what to me is the big main message, which is eat food, not too much, mostly plants. I mean, the whole edifice of nutritional science, when you really look at it, that's all you need to know. It's a little easier said than done. You know, not too much. Well, how do you govern appetite? That's such a problem for so many people. And eat food, isn't that everything? No. The markets are full of what I call edible food-like substances also that you have to avoid. So a lot of the rules are to help you, you know, navigate that now very treacherous landscape of the American supermarket.
Well, step back for a second. What is it that you mean by the nutritional industrial complex?
Well, there is a very kind of cozy relationship between nutritional science as it's practiced in the universities and in the government, and the kinds of advice that emerges from that research, and the food industry, which does a very good job of taking any shred of new information, like, oh, maybe fiber prevents colon cancer, and then go to town with really dubious health claims about it. A lot of the research is very tentative, and it's changing because people really, I mean, the great open secret about nutritional science is it's a very young science, to put it charitably. They really don't know a lot. They still haven't gotten straight whether we should worry more about fats or carbohydrates with regard to heart disease. But whenever they come out with a new finding, the industry uses that to sell more food to people. And so the great example in our own time is the low-fat campaign, a big public health campaign really begun by the government in the 1970s under Senator George McGovern's leadership. He was chair of the Select Committee on Nutrition. And they thought they were doing something really good, which was telling people to eat less meat and cut down on saturated fat. But this was seized on by the industry, which took what had been a critique of what they were doing and turned it into a very clever new way to sell new food. So they re-engineered the whole food supply to have less fat, but more carbohydrates. And so people binged on low-fat foods, like Snackwells was the great example. Remember that line of, you know, it was basically no-fat junk food that Nabisco came out with, and it was all over the supermarket for a few years there in the 80s. And people felt, well, if one of these is better for me, a whole box is even better. And so people binged on low-fat food. And since the low-fat campaign started, we have gotten an average of 18 pounds heavier. So it hasn't worked. And the reason it didn't work was, well, there are two theories. One is maybe the science about fat was wrong, which is increasingly becoming clear, not certain, but clearer. Or maybe whenever you demonize one nutrient, you're giving a free pass to another, and you're allowing the industry to come up with what it always wants to do, which is another eat more message. And they did. They're really clever. I mean, I found it in my own work, to the extent I've demonized high fructose corn syrup in the last few years, or talked about the importance of simple foods with few ingredients. They now have those things, and they
isn't ice cream named after you?
Five. Well, no, I don't know if it's me, but
Michael Five Pump.
You know,
explain five.
Well, I'm not the only person who was saying, you know, if you want to avoid heavily processed foods, choose foods that have five ingredients or less. Haagen-Dazs looked at their ingredients and say, hey, we only have five. Let's advertise this fact. They didn't change anything, so they started calling their new line of ice cream Five. And
you get royalties on this?
I wish. And now there are all these products that have been reformulated with real sugar, as if that's health food. So there's an implicit health claim suddenly on sugar that was created by the critique of high fructose corn syrup. So you see, they're much smarter than I am, or any of the critics are.
But explain the issue and the problem with high fructose corn syrup.
Well, I mean, the reason I have suggested that you should avoid products with high fructose corn syrup is not that we have science proving that it is a worse form of sugar than conventional cane sugar.
Now, again, it's made out of corn.
It's made from corn. It's a very complex process that was invented by the Japanese in the 70s, and it's really has been a boon to the food industry. Because high fructose corn syrup is very cheap because we subsidize the corn, and it has various properties of food science that are very valuable. If you put it in a bread product, it gets a nice brown coating, and it actually helps prevent freezer burn in frozen foods. So, and you make any food sweeter and we'll eat more of it. So they're putting it in everything. So if you can avoid high fructose corn syrup, you're probably avoiding a heavily processed food that you should avoid anyway. So that's why I said don't eat it. But is it worse than sugar? Not necessarily. Both of them are about 50-50 glucose and fructose. They're joined in a different way. Some people think that might affect absorption rates, but let's assume they're the same. And so they've come back and reformulated a bunch of products with sugar. And they've said with real sugar now, or with no high fructose corn syrup. And people, you know, how do you read that? You say, well, if they're boasting about it, it must be healthier. And so we now are, we've created a health claim for sugar, and I feel somewhat responsible because it's very deceptive. So I came up with a rule to avoid all these schemes, which is don't buy any food you see advertised on television. That's the only way to avoid their marketing cleverness. And that rule captures most processed food because two-thirds of ad budgets go to heavily processed food. Only about 5% of ad budgets go to, you know, prunes or walnuts or real foods. So I'm hoping that your common sense will not, you know, will allow you not to tar them with the same brush.
And why this big change in the American diet? I mean, over the past century, we're eating differently. How has the industry changed and affected our eating habits?
Well, there are a lot of causes. Some are technological, many are social. Basically, the business model of the food industry Because it's based on these agricultural commodities, the price of which are always falling, corn and soy and wheat, the way you make money in such an economy is by processing, by adding value. So you take that corn, which is, it's been as low as $1.50 a bushel, and let us remind your readers how much corn that is. It's a bushel basket. It's 56 pounds of kernels, okay? That's really cheap for food or a raw ingredient for food. So you can't really eat this stuff. And so you make money the more you trick it up. So, for example, a potato is 69 cents a pound, okay? Not a lot of money. But Terra Yukon Gold French fries, I'm sorry, potato chips come to $10.37 a pound, okay? A lot of